Let me remind you of the requirements for a good argument. The first requirement is validity, a tight logical connection between premises and conclusion. In order to be valid, the reasons given for the conclusion must really support that conclusion. The conclusion must really follow from the premises. At its strongest, validity is deductive validity, Aristotle style. There, the connection is airtight. Given the truth of the premises, the truth of the conclusion is absolutely guaranteed. More broadly, validity demands a strong logical connection between premises and conclusion, even if not absolutely guaranteed. Do the reasons give us convincing evidence for the conclusion? Do they give solid reason to believe it? The first requirement is validity, that the premises, if true, will lead us by strong logic to the conclusion. The second requirement for a good argument is that the premises actually be true. A sound argument is one that's both valid and has premises which are indeed true. That's the kind of argument that will give us a conclusion we can rely on. That's a good argument. In this lecture, I want to go over to the dark side. In this lecture, I want to give you some really bad arguments. That sounds terrible, doesn't it? Of course, I'm not going to try to persuade you with bad arguments. I'm going to try to vaccinate you against them. Bad arguments, like flu germs, are all around us. But we can prepare ourselves with a flu shot that strengthens the immune system against expected types. With bad arguments, we can prepare ourselves by learning to recognize the most common forms, the usual suspects. If you can see them coming, you can more easily detect and diffuse them. There are bad argument types that reappear over and over again. Those standard forms of bad arguments are called fallacies. What I want to give you is a tour of some standard fallacies. The idea is, once again, to rely on your pattern recognition abilities. I want you to be able to say, "Ah, I recognize that pattern of argument. One of the usual suspects. It even has a name. That's an ad hominem argument." We've already talked about some standard forms of bad argument. Appeal to emotion and the straw man fallacy appeared in Schopenhauer's list of rhetorical tricks. Here we'll cover some more. In each case, I'll start out with simple examples. As I go along, I'll occasionally stop to review by asking you to name that fallacy. How many kinds of bogus arguments are there? All too many. I'm not even sure there's a limit. Were I to try to give you a complete list of all the ways an argument can go bad, I'll bet some clever advertising executive could come up with a new one. A first warning, then, is that I can't give you an exhaustive list. We'll just hit some of the most common offenders. A second warning is this. When people start to recognize bogus arguments, they often want a single answer to the question, "What's wrong with this argument?" But an argument can go wrong lots of different ways at once. There's no guarantee that only one fallacy will be committed. I'm going to be using lots of examples. Fallacies appear in social and political argument all the time, and I'll be using a number of social and political examples. Let me make it clear that those are only examples. I'm not pushing any particular agenda on any of those issues. Bad arguments appear on just about every side of every issue. And of course, the fact that someone supports a conclusion with a bad argument doesn't mean that there might not be a better argument that supports the same conclusion. First stop on the tour of bad arguments. Every parent is familiar with the refrain, "But everybody else is doing it." Every parent is also familiar with the appropriate reply, "That's no reason why you should." The fact that everybody else is doing it is no reason why you should. And the fact that everybody else believes something is no reason why you should. Arguments which treat majority opinion as if that alone constituted a reason for belief commit the fallacy of appeal to the majority. Here's a simple example.
The majority of the population thinks we coddle criminals. It's time we got tough on crime.
The premise? A majority of the population thinks we coddle criminals. The conclusion? It's time we got tough on crime. Just how much support does that premise give for that conclusion? Not much. That's the fallacy of appeal to the majority. Sometimes the appeal isn't even to a majority.
A significant portion of the population takes UFO sightings seriously. UFOs are real.
Fallacious for the same reason, right? There's a simple fact that diffuses a number of common fallacies, including appeal to the majority. It's this. The fact that someone believes something doesn't make it so. We're all fallible. Anybody could be wrong. I don't care who you are, the President of the United States, or the head of NASA, or the chair of the physics department. Nobody is exempt from the possibility of error. It's never the case that something is true just because you believe it's true. You aren't that important to the universe. It's not all about you. You hope that what you believe is true, but the truth doesn't depend on what you happen to believe. The fact that someone believes something doesn't make it so. The fact that a whole bunch of people believe something doesn't make it so. The fact that a majority of people believe something doesn't make it so. So maybe it's true that we coddle criminals. Maybe it's true that there are UFOs. But in order for an argument to give us a solid reason to believe those things, it had better offer something stronger than the fact that some people, lots of people, maybe even a majority of people, believe those things. You may not be tempted by appeal to the majority. It's too obviously fallacious. Here's a fallacy that just about everyone has committed, and has committed on themselves. Two things happen in sequence, and we conclude they must be causally connected. The name of the fallacy is a bit of Latin, post hoc ergo propter hoc. What it means is, this came after this, so it must have been because of this. Post hoc ergo propter hoc, or post hoc for short. Here's how we fall victim. I'm waiting for my friends to arrive. They said they were coming over this afternoon, but I've been waiting and waiting. Finally, I decide to call them. I pick up the phone, and they drive in the driveway. Good thing I picked up that phone. Brains seem to be wired to make connections, even connections that aren't really there. Much of what is termed superstitious behavior is grounded in post hoc ergo propter hoc. Professional baseball is a prime example. Outfielder John White gave the typical story, I was jogging out to center field when I picked up a scrap of paper. I got some good hits that night, and I guess I decided that the paper had something to do with it. The next night I picked up a gum wrapper and had another good night. I've been picking up paper every night since. Wade Boggs eats chicken before every game because he thought he did well as a rookie after eating chicken. Clint Barnes' ankle was taped after he sprained it. Because he started hitting well, he insisted it be taped up long after the sprain had healed. Elements of ritual build up. As Dennis Grossini, a pitcher on the Detroit farm team, said, you can't really tell what's most important, so it all becomes important. I'd be afraid to change anything. As long as I'm winning, I do everything the same. So Turk Wendell chews four pieces of black licorice while pitching, insists on throwing the rosin bag down hard, draws three crosses in the dirt. Mike Hargrove was a first baseman for the Cleveland Indians. He built up such an elaborate routine he was known as the human rain delay, all because of post hoc ergo propter hoc. Sometimes things are just coincidences. The fact that A happened and then B happened doesn't show that A caused B. Let me give you a third bad argument type with another Latin name, ad hominem. An ad hominem argument is one that attacks the opponent himself as a person rather than his position. Ad hominem means against the person. Here it is in a simple form. You're in a debate. Your opponent has argued brilliantly that racial profiling is both unconstitutional and morally wrong, that it violates inherent human rights. It's your turn, and you say, "Where'd you get that shirt, Nutmeg? If you notice, your socks don't match. Where'd you get that argument off the back of a candy wrapper? Your mother wears army boots." Of course, ad hominem is often a bit more subtle. Here's another example.
The Republicans say we should shrink the deficit and cut down on government spending. But these are the same people who cranked up the deficit by getting us into two wars simultaneously. And these are the same people who cranked up the deficit by giving tax breaks to the rich. Yeah, and these are the same people who gave us the Bush years of massive spending, which was more than any other administration from either party.
What's really at issue here is the claim that we should shrink the deficit and cut down on government spending. But in fact, that claim is never addressed at all. What we get instead is an attack on the people who put it forward. That's ad hominem, an attack on the person rather than the claim. With truth and rationality on the line, what's important is the quality of the argument itself. If the argument is solid, it doesn't matter where it came from. Put it this way. Good arguments are good arguments in the dark. They are good arguments even if you can't see who's giving them. That's the principle violated by the fallacy of ad hominem. Ad hominem applies to any case in which the attack is on the person rather than the argument. There are two specific forms of ad hominem that reappear again and again, particularly in election years. The first is tu quoque, Latin for "you also," or more colloquially, "you did it too." The last example I gave you was a tu quoque form of ad hominem.
The Republicans say we should shrink the deficit and cut down on government spending. But these are the same people who cranked up the deficit by getting us into two wars simultaneously.
That's tu quoque. Does it show that they're wrong about the deficit and government spending? No. The most it shows is that Republicans have also been part of the problem. Here's another tu quoque.
Well, the U.S. says that North Korea is stockpiling nuclear weapons and is therefore a threat to world peace. But surely both Israel and the U.S. have their own stockpiles of nuclear weapons.
Does this show that North Korea is not stockpiling nuclear weapons? Or that it's not a danger to world peace? No. It's just a "you did it too." A second form of ad hominem is poisoning the well. Like all ad hominems, it involves an attack on the person rather than the argument, but specifically an attack on someone's motives for saying what they do. They're just saying that because you can't trust water from that well. That's poisoning the well. Those who opposed the invasion of Iraq were quick to speculate regarding motives. Bush wanted to finish his father's work or show his father he was stronger. Dick Cheney's Halliburton just wanted bigger contracts, or they were all out for the oil. If the invasion of Iraq was a bad idea, it was a bad idea independently of what motivated it. The same's true if it was a good idea. Talk of motivations didn't touch the real issue. In 2004, when campaigning for the presidency, John Kerry published a misery index intended to show that things had gotten worse under the Bush administration. The other side fired back, "John Kerry talks about the economy because he thinks it'll benefit him politically." True, perhaps, but irrelevant. That's just poisoning the well. Ad hominem. Okay, are you ready? It's time to play Name That Fallacy. I want you to listen to these three arguments. In each case, I want you to tell me what fallacy is being committed. Here's the first one.
As you know, most European countries have abolished the death penalty, with Turkey being the only country in recent years to carry out the death sentence. So it's clear the death penalty is immoral.
Here's argument number two.
All you hear in the current campaign is we need someone in Washington who's not a professional politician. But the people making that claim are lobbyists and politicians. So much for that claim.
Here's argument number three.
In 2011, Illinois abolished the death penalty. Did murders increase after abolition? No, they actually continued to decline. So why can't people understand that the death penalty doesn't prevent murders? It actually causes them.
Did you get those? The first one was an appeal to the majority. The premise was that most European countries have abolished the death penalty. Here, the majority was countries, but the spirit's exactly the same. The conclusion was that the death penalty is immoral. But believing it so doesn't make it so, even when we're talking about the beliefs of a bunch of countries. That's the fallacy of appeal to the majority. The second one, ad hominem. The claim at issue was that we need a Washington outsider. A good argument would give us reasons to believe that's not true. But that's not what we get. What we get instead is an attack on the people making that claim, that they themselves are Washington insiders. The attack is on the people making the claim, not the claim itself. Ad hominem. Can you tell me the specific kind? That's right, tu quoque, you too. And the last one, post hoc ergo propter hoc. What the premise gives us is two data points. Illinois abolished the death penalty in 2011. Murders continued to fall after abolition. That's all we've got. The conclusion drawn is that there was a causal connection between those data points. Post hoc ergo propter hoc. Roll up your sleeve. I want to inoculate you against another fallacy, the fallacy of false alternative, also called false dilemma. The trick of a false alternative or false dilemma is to set things up as if the opponent has to choose either A or B. It's a false alternative because it may not be true at all. There may be lots more options open.
Look, either you marry Julie and have a wonderful life and family, or you spend the rest of your life as a lonely bachelor. Now go ahead, make up your mind. Julie's waiting.
That's clearly a false alternative. Are those your only options? Of course not. A lonely bachelor? Maybe you'll live your life as a gregarious, fun-loving bachelor instead. You might end up marrying Julie and not having a wonderful life. You could move to Alaska, start a commune, marry someone else, and live happily ever after. Sorry, Mom. Bogus argument. That's a false alternative. There's a famous case of false alternative used by George W. Bush in the State of the Union address. Either you're with us or you're with the terrorists. But as I said in the beginning, neither side has a lockdown on fallacies. Barack Obama used false alternatives in a State of the Union address as well, not once but twice. Either we ask the wealthiest Americans to pay their fair share in taxes, or we're going to have to ask seniors to pay more for Medicare. We can't afford to do both. Either we gut education and medical research, or we've got to reform the tax code so that the most profitable corporations have to give up tax loopholes that other companies don't get. We can't afford to do both. Options in both cases are far more complex than that. It's not just an either or. Trying to make it look that way is the fallacy of false alternative. Here's a fallacy that takes the nefarious strategy of the false alternative a little farther. It's called the complex question. The classic example is a lawyer who's prosecuting someone for wife beating. The accused is put on the stand and told to answer merely yes or no to the questions put to him. The prosecutor says, "Tell me, Mr. Smith, have you stopped beating your wife yet?" He's got to say yes or no. But if he says yes, the prosecutor says, "Aha, you say you have stopped beating your wife, so you admit you beat her in the past, I rest my case." If he says no, the prosecutor says, "What? You say you haven't stopped beating your wife? You admit you're still beating her? I rest my case." It's a trick question. It's a trap. The defendant is forced to say yes or no. Either answer is legitimate, only on a certain assumption that he has beaten his wife. He's forced into a false alternative, each side of which begs the question against him. Hasty generalization is a fallacy of jumping to a conclusion. You know something about a small number of things. You jump to a conclusion about all of them.
The first person I met on Long Island was short and rude. The second person I met on Long Island was short and rude. I guess everybody on Long Island must be short and rude.
Racist and sexist generalizations are one of the worst kinds of generalizations, and those are quite generally hasty generalizations.
Did you see what that Polish guy did? Polish people must be stupid.
Every Italian guy that's come in this week has bought shoe polish. Italians just want to buy shoe polish.
Every woman I've dated was a big tipper. Women are just big tippers.
Hasty generalizations wrong for all kinds of reasons. In other lectures, we've talked about the fallacy of appeal to emotion. The purpose of argument is to give solid reasons for believing a conclusion. An appeal to emotion is intended to short-circuit rationality, to manipulate a hearer by pressing emotional buttons instead. Appeal to ignorance is equally illegitimate. Here the fallacy is to act as if our ignorance is something more than it is, as if ignorance alone gives us some kind of positive evidence. Here's an example.
Many ships and planes have utterly disappeared in the regions of the Bermuda Triangle, often without explanation, without physical trace. There must be some kind of mysterious force at work beneath the waves.
Earlier, I emphasized a simple fact. Believing it so doesn't make it so. Here's another simple fact. Ignorance is just ignorance. If we don't know something, we just don't know it. Ignorance isn't by itself evidence for something. A mysterious force beneath the waves, for example. Evidence for a mysterious force would require real evidence, not just ignorance, not just lack of evidence. Here's another example.
How do we know that Oswald acted alone? How do we know this wasn't some massive conspiracy and that our own government hasn't simply covered it up? We haven't yet heard the real truth about the Kennedy assassination.
You'll notice that's driven entirely by nothing more than questions. The argument works entirely from ignorance and yet treats how do we know as if it offered a definite conclusion. We haven't yet heard the truth about the Kennedy assassination. Could there be grounds to think that? Certainly. But a bunch of questions aren't grounds. They're just questions. Okay, are you ready for another round? It's time to play Name That Fallacy. This time it'll be cumulative. Watch for all the fallacies we've mentioned. I'll give you three arguments. You tell me the fallacies.
First, they tell us that hormone replacement therapy is good for the health of women after menopause. Comes to find out, hormone replacement therapy actually leads to some serious health risks. First, they tell us that a certain medication is good for avoiding high blood pressure and heart disease. Then they'd say that that same medication is linked to diabetes, which is itself linked to heart disease. So I guess you really just can't trust medical research.
Here's a second argument.
No one knows exactly how the ancient pyramids were built, but why did the ancient South Americans, separated by thousands of miles, build pyramids just as the ancient Egyptians did? How did primitive peoples erect the massive pillars of Stonehenge? And how were the stones of Machu Picchu fitted so closely together that even a knife cannot slip between them? The answer is obviously the influence of ancient astronauts.
Argument number three.
It's time to use the three strikes law to get tough on crime. Anyone that gets convicted of three felonies should go to jail for life. Look, we gotta make a choice. You either slam the door and throw away the key, or we're just coddling these people, encouraging recidivism, and using our prison system to educate career criminals. In Washington state, the law passed with a majority. In California, it was 72% of the vote. It's time to use three strikes to get tough on crime.
Did you catch the fallacies? The first one was a hasty generalization. We have two cases in which health recommendations have been reversed. That's hardly grounds for the conclusion that we can't trust any medical research. Hasty generalization. No one knows exactly how the pyramids were built. Exactly. No one knows. From that ignorance, it doesn't follow that ancient astronauts were responsible, nor, of course, that they weren't. The third argument was a tricky one because it involved two fallacies. Look, we've got to make a choice. Either we coddle criminals or go for three strikes. That's a false alternative. California passed it with 72% voter approval. That's appeal to the majority. As I said at the beginning, there's no guarantee that you won't find two or more fallacies being committed at the same time. My aim in this lecture was to vaccinate you against some standard forms of bogus arguments, to inoculate you against some fallacies. I want to finish with a question as to how this fits in with some of our earlier work. That question might be posed as a set of challenges. Wait a minute. One of the other lecturers introduced wisdom of crowds as a positive heuristic. Isn't that just appeal to the majority? What about the example of which is larger, San Antonio or San Diego? The German students made a correct inference from the fact that they had heard of San Diego and not of San Antonio. Isn't that just appeal to ignorance? The conclusion of another lecturer was that in short-range decisions, it may be rational to go with your gut. Isn't that just an instance of hasty generalization? Take a closer look, and you'll see that there are important differences. Wisdom of crowds doesn't just recommend that you think what everybody else thinks. It's a strategy for extracting knowledge from a distribution of opinions where some people really do know the answer, like the studio audience of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. It doesn't just copy other people's beliefs, like appeal to the majority does. It draws a clever inference, though a fallible one, from the distribution of beliefs. In the San Diego-San Antonio case, the German students did better than Americans in picking the larger city precisely because they knew something about one and were largely ignorant of the other. Why have I heard of San Diego and I'm not so sure about San Antonio? Maybe because it's larger. That's a clever inference, though admittedly a risky one. It's not a simple jump from, I don't know how ancient monuments were built, to, it must have been ancient astronauts. There's also an important difference of context. When there's no time for careful investigation, when you have to get out of the way of an oncoming train, fast and frugal heuristics are precisely what you need. Better to go with your gut and jump to a conclusion, even if it might be wrong, than to wait on the tracks trying to calculate the velocity of an approaching locomotive. In the case of explicit argument, the standards for rationality are higher. There we want more than a handy heuristic. When someone is trying to convince us of a conclusion, and when we do have time to really think about it, it's important to test how tight the logic really is. Do the premises really support the conclusion? How strongly? Does the conclusion really follow? Or is this a bogus argument built with fallacious reasoning? We'll do more with that next time. It'll be your turn to evaluate arguments in the great debate.